Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from August 31st, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Anyasota Sutta, the Sutta on the pitfalls of going with the flow. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
When I think about this sutta, I think about who I was in high school, and the many different personalities I took on to fit with the whatever group I was enamored with. So I started out as a jock, and I looked like a jock. And then I became a preppy, and I looked like a preppy. And then I became very enamored with being a hippie, and I looked completely different then when I was part of the hippies. And then I got to that phase I think a lot of teenagers get to, and I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that I didn't care about anything. And I took that on, it took a while to realize that that was what most of the people were trying to create in their lives too. So this is this sutta kind of relates to that, and if you take it in the context that the Buddha taught, he's cautioning against that the strong societal influence to belong to something and to create an identity over something. In other words, to go with the flow, to go with what's going on around us, and whatever seems most appealing. And that really what that is, what's most appealing, is usually what we decide. Remember, rooted in ignorance, it's usually what we decide is going to most establish our ego personality. That's what we attach to, and that's what we go with. So the same problem, the Buddha noticed this during his time in within his own Sangha. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches that there are four types of individuals in the world. Keep in mind that the Buddha is teaching the Dhamma, and these four types of people can include anyone, even those with no knowledge or interest in the Dhamma. He's just classifying the way people choose the path of least resistance, meaning through their associations. More specifically, he is teaching that a Dhamma practitioner will likely lose the way if they are influenced through clinging to go with the flow and maintain or develop unskillful practices in order to fit the Dhamma to conditioned beliefs or worldly influences. And this is getting more to the point. The Buddha wasn't concerned, and I guess I would say I'm not concerned with people that didn't really have an interest in the Dhamma, except understanding that it would be wonderful if everybody would take a look at this and at least examine it for their own benefit. But most specifically, it's quite a challenge to stay focused even within the Buddhist Dhamma, especially today, but I think obviously even during the Buddhist time. And that's one of the reasons why he taught an Eightfold Path, to frame our practice. Now, much of modern Buddhism either diminishes the importance of the Eightfold Path or dismisses it outright by saying that it's an archaic practice that really isn't relevant to today, when that's the Eightfold Path is the only path the Buddha ever taught. The Buddha's words: there are four types of individuals in the phenomenal world. There is the individual who goes with the flow. There is the individual who goes against the flow. There is the individual who remains steady in the Dhamma. And there is the individual who has gained release from clinging, whose mind is settled in equanimity, an arahant. Notice the subtle differences between the last two. The individual who goes with the flow continues to indulge their sensual passions and performs mindless deeds. These will continue in confusion and disappointment. Also notice that there's no judgment or condemnation in what the Buddha is saying. He's simply stating the truth. The individual who goes against the flow does not indulge their sensual passions or perform mindless deeds, even though they still feel pain and sorrow. They do so with mindfulness. They live the wholesome life that is pure. The individual who remains in the Dhamma has ended the five fetters. They will achieve the unbound. They will be released. The individual who has gained release from clinging, their mind settled in equanimity, the Arahant, has ended their mental fabrications. They are released from clinging to objects and views. Their mindfulness steady and unmoving. I just want to go back to those last two. Those last two definitions. One who is engaged in Dhamma practice, as long as they continue in that Dhamma practice, meaning they have ceased going with the flow, will eventually awaken and gain full human maturity. And then he describes that last class of people that have actually developed the Dhamma. Their minds are released, they're arahants, they're awakened, they're fully mature human beings. These are the four types of individuals to be found in the phenomenal world. People unrestrained in sensual passions, indulging sensuality, will continue their confusion and suffering. Seized by desire, it's a strong word, isn't it? But seized by desire, I mean, you are seized. You need something to get out of that, don't you? Seized by desire, going with the flow. The enlightened one, with mindfulness well established, having abandoned sense desires and mindlessness, experiencing disappointment and disenchantment, they go against the flow. Having abandoned the five fetters, they are perfect in their practice. They will not lose their way. With mindfulness and composure, they remain steady. Having gained release from clinging, all fetters destroyed. Their confusion and suffering have ended. They have done all that there is to be done. There is nothing left for distraction. I'm sorry. There is nothing left for distraction and disappointment to cling. That's the end of the Buddha's words there. With the almost infinite distractions of the world today, included what is considered Dhamma practice, it is often difficult to not go with the flow and engage in popular practices or ideas. The most difficult influence to going with the flow is our own conditioned minds. It is the nature of a conditioned mind to insist on maintaining its conditioning, to continue going with its own flow. It's the nature of a conditioned mind to cling. And so anything that will serve as a further distraction, a self-referential ego mind will cling to it. And that's another way of saying we're going with the flow. We cling to something that will continue that distraction. Remember, the Buddha awakened to dependent origination that states from ignorance through 12 observable links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering arises. That's another way of saying clinging to conditioned mind. A conditioned mind creates strategies to enable it to continue to ignore its own ignorance. Is that last line clear? There's more to the article, but I think I'll stop there. Is that clear what I just said? A conditioned mind will create strategies to ignore anything that would challenge its own ignorance. And the most powerful strategy, I think, is the associations we make. And because of the associations we make, we take a type of groupthink, saying, well, so many people are thinking this way, it must be right. We don't even challenge it. When the Buddha awakened, let me preface that by saying, when the Buddha was the most radical thinker of his time, and I would say for all time, even, you know, carrying through the last 2,600 years, because he was able to recognize that clinging, craving, conditioned mind rooted in ignorance. That is what he awakened to. That's the brilliance of what he awakened to. Up until that point, in a few weeks I'm going to give another talk on the Nagara Sutta where the Buddha describes his awakening. Up until that point, he was stuck in this same feedback loop of his own associations. And he could not understand. He had a gnawing feeling deep inside of him that he wasn't seeing things clearly, or he was missing something. And I think we all feel that in some way. We feel it no matter what's going on in our life, something's missing. We don't quite get it. That's probably what brought us all together tonight, is looking for that something else. And that can be called the great search, the great spiritual quest. That's what set the Buddha off. That's why he left the palace. That's why he left that incredible life that his father, the king, was offering him. And it said, no, this isn't it. He described even that wonderful life that he was living as a confining place. To him, it wasn't great fortune that he had found by being born in his father's palace. It was a prison. And it was a prison because he didn't understand what was missing in his own life. He saw that as a confining place. But he also looked out on the world and realized that everybody was caught up in this loop of their associations. The Buddha often teaches during his different suttas that what we associate with, whether physically or through our thinking process, what we associate with, we will become. That's another way of saying going with the flow. And like I did in high school, I went from this group to that group to that group to that group. Whatever I was enamored with at the moment, whatever I felt would give me the most stature is really what I was doing. And again, I was 12 to 16 or 18 years old. We all do that. And I also continued it beyond that, like most people do. Because a self-referential ego personality is threatened each and every moment to continue to establish itself, it's always grasping. The second noble truth is craving or grasping establishes this ongoing process of suffering rooted in ignorance, and clinging continues it. We cling to our associations. We cling to whatever we've established as going with the flow. Now, as we begin to develop, let me again take that back one step. Those of us that have recognized that gnawing disappointment and start looking for something else, even if we might be wildly successful or wildly fortunate like the Buddha was, or we may have a life that is prone to the common human difficulties, or we may have great suffering in our lives, at some point we realize that there's got to be another way, at least another way of looking at the world. And so we start engaging in spiritual practices. I did everything that was available to me in the New Age lexicon and in all the different Buddhist schools. I was telling Matt tonight a couple of stories about when I was involved in Hawaiian shamanism. And I really thought that was, and at the time, I guess it was to me, it was the most incredible thing I've ever come across. I had one of the most well-recognized throughout history Hawaiian shamans as my teacher. And I was very fortunate to have him. He's a wonderful man. In fact, he is mentioned in the Smithsonian Institute as a great purveyor of Hawaiian teachings. That didn't do it for me. But during that time, I was strongly associated and I went with that flow. I was spending a lot of time in Hawaii hanging around with his name was Uncle George. And I say that with a lot of affection. With all of his group and all of his associations, they all became my friends. I went through all the different Buddhist schools and found them all lacking. But while I was in there, and the whole point of that, while I was part of whatever group I was part of that group. That's how I identified myself. And it wasn't until I looked at what the Buddha actually taught that I was able to even recognize that I was continually going with the flow of whatever I was enamored with, whatever I was associating with. And so people will say, well, aren't you going with the flow of what the Buddha taught? And that's a reasonable question. Except the Buddha taught a path that directly shows our clinging and attachments to whatever beliefs they are in a way to recognize them and abandon them. So there's people that would ask me, well, what type of Buddhist are you? Are you a Mahayana, Hinayana? Are you a Theravadan? Are you a Zen? And there's always this need to define yourself as something in modern Buddhism. And so most people, if they first come to my website and read what I have and maybe read my books, they'll say, well, he's a Theravadan, because Theravadan means the teachings of the elders, meaning that it's the teachings that are as most closely related to what the Buddha actually taught. And in a sense, that's true, but I'm not a Theravadan Buddhism. Most Theravadan Buddhisms take their major teachings from a book called the Abhidhamma, which is something that came much later after the Buddha's death. I don't describe myself as anyone except someone who follows the Four Noble Truths. And so there's my association. You could say that that's the flow that I go with, but that's also the flow that the Buddha teaches. Those that go, that develop the Dhamma, will develop awakening. And those that have fully developed the Dhamma, these are the last two classifications that he talks about, are Arahants. They're fully awakened human beings. Someone brought up on Tuesday's class, because someone was questioning them, well, isn't it clinging when you when you cling to meditate twice a day? Isn't it clinging that you're clinging to the Dhamma? Isn't it clinging when you go to that silly Sangha once or twice or three times a week? Well, you can certainly look at it that way and you could denigrate it that way. But what you're doing is simply taking an association that's rooted in ignorance and now associating yourself with something that is likely to deliver awakening, a calm and peaceful mind and a life of lasting peace and happiness. And that's the choice. And that gets back to the refined mindfulness that the Buddha teaches, rooted in the concentration that's developed in Samatha Vipassana meditation. What we hold in mind, and this is again going back to this teaching on going in with the flow, what we hold in mind will determine our experience. And that's pretty obvious, isn't it? That's not some great mystical saying, although there's been a lot of books that are written in a mystical way saying just that. Thinking back to Napoleon Hill. Does everybody know anybody know who Napoleon Hill is? He was a great success/spiritual teacher, writer, going back to about the 20s, maybe the 30s. And he wrote some really great books that are geared towards physical and usually really financial or business success, but using spiritual principles. One of the books that he wrote is, I can't think of it, Thoughts or Things. And what the whole book was about, a little book, was that whatever you hold in mind is going to be the extent of your experience. And that led to later developments of creative visualization and that whole kind of movement that began in the mid-70s and is still prevalent today. What we hold in mind will determine our experience. Of course, that only goes so far. I could think about $20 million and hold $20 million in my mind continually. I'm likely just wasting my time. It would be just a coincidence if somehow I came across $20 million. But that's because, and the reason why the system breaks down is because that's based on an ego, isn't it? But when I hold in mind principles, this is why the Four Noble Truths are called Noble Truths. When I hold those truths in mind, what will manifest is the result of those truths. So I'm not trying to create something out of nothing. I'm not trying to establish a self-referential ego self. I'm simply developing a way of looking at the world and a way of being mindful to recognize all views rooted in ignorance and put them aside. And that's the great difference between clinging to something that is rooted in ignorance and developing something that is rooted in wisdom. So we have a choice in each and every moment, and that choice can change. Sometimes we can be well focused on going with the flow, using the framework of the Eightfold Path as our life. And then something occurs, and we lose that focus for a moment. But because we have established right effort, and we know that no matter what's occurred today, this evening I'm going to spend 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes or a half an hour in meditation and deepening my concentration, I can come back into that, use the word, the right association. And as I continue to develop the framework of the Eightfold Path, as the framework for my life, when I fall out of that right association, I'll be able to recognize it much quicker. And I won't continue to go down that path that's rooted in ignorance. And I can get back on the path that will develop awakening, on becoming awakened. That's the talk for tonight. Thank you. Before we go around the room, any questions on the Anyasota Sutta or my talk directly? No? Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, John. Appreciate this talk. It's an interesting time for you to give this. I've been reading some other I guess I would call them esoteric works, and it was funny, this person was in the intro to one of the books was speaking about the way the mind works, the logical mind, and then the sort of esoteric mind. It's the logical mind is kind of the lowest one, sort of going with the flow mind, as you mentioned, the association. Oh, well, what kind of Buddhist are you? Well, because that, you have to have an association with a group. It's like a church or like that type of faith. So that's the logical mind. And that's what most of humanity is working in, the logical mind. It has to make sense. Well, oh, I see why you do that, because it's an association for you. But it's completely, you know, not that. And then sort of this esoteric mind is sort of, you don't need the logic to know why it worked or how it worked, but the fact that some people did it, some people have done this, right? Like the Buddha, for example. Yeah. So it's interesting that you bring that up. And the four, it's just very, it's a lot of synchronicity. So it was funny to see. And, I've encountered that too. You know, well, what's this practice you're speaking of? And it's just more important to take refuge now than any other time, at least in my life. And you know, if you're looking for that association, then, or going with the flow, that's completely the antithetical of what this being cultivated here. That's not a calm mind, because you're constantly looking to go and attach to something. Like, you know, but cultivating a sense of stillness and emptying, as we're all talking about in this whole practice, doesn't need to be an association. The association is you know, this path. Yeah. There's nothing else outside of this, you know. And the mind and the conditioning will do everything possible to ignore these truths, these Four Noble Truths. It's constantly going to try and cling and establish itself with another group, or, you know, like you said before, just setting an intention with $20 million or whatever it is. That's just preserving the I in another realm. It's still rooted in ignorance.
Yeah.
So it's just neat how you brought that up, and I appreciate the talk. So.
Thank you. Yeah, good timing. Yesterday, the Wednesday Dhamma talk was on Sada, the question of faith. And because any religion is seen as something that's faith-based, but the Buddha didn't teach anything to be taken on faith. He taught it to be directly developed and have the experience of it. There's
I have to see that, right?
Yeah, there's nothing logical in relation to how the world sees things, because anything like this, it looks like you're taking it, have to take it on faith. But you don't. There's a direct path to developing this, and you have the experience yourself. And every one of us has talked about having the experience of the practical experience of developing a more well-concentrated, more mindful presence in the world. And that's what it's all about. So, glad you made it tonight. Good to see you. Mike, good to see you. How are you?
I'm well, John. Good to see you. Very nice to be here, as always. I enjoyed that very much, and made me think a lot about... I've always wanted to be part of a group.
Yeah.
A lot of that comes from, I'm an only child. Believe it or not, looking at me, I grew up a minority where I live. I lived in a very ethnic community that I wasn't part of that. I'm a member of that ethnicity. I don't have any relatives who are in my age range. Cousins are all older than me. And so I've always, you know, wanted to be part of a broader group on some level or whatever. And I really tend to question myself and my thinking, because inevitably I'll get involved with some kind of group and I'll get disappointed by something that's going on. A lot of times it's people acting like they're in high school. No matter what the goal of the group is, you're still going to have these little petty squabbles and, you know, egos and power plays. But, I think I told you I was a member of a fraternal organization for a while until recently. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. So now I spend my volunteer time working at a farm that takes in abused and neglected horses. Mm-hmm. So I question myself, like, is there something about me that I'm pushing people away? Am I somehow intolerant of their intolerance or something? I always find myself coming back to wondering, because it, you know, seems like I'm intentionally trying to push them away, but I'm wondering if maybe I'm trying to go away from a flow on some level.
I'm sorry, were you finished?
Yeah.
Because you could see that there was something coming
out,
ready to jump out of my mouth. Thank you for bringing that up, because it really depends on
if you're developing this understanding through the framework of the Eightfold Path, it's certainly not intolerant to recognize that the skillfulness of disentangling yourself from those types of worldly influences. That's really precisely what clinging is. It means we're clinging to self-identities, and those identities are always clinging to something external, whether it's a group of people or an ideal or anything like that. So it's certainly not intolerant. It's skillful. You could look at it in a way that it's being intolerant and judgmental of a group, such as the group, I know the group that you're talking about. It's simply skillful to preserve a common, peaceful mind. And so there's nothing harshly judgmental about these teachings. And notice there was nothing in the Buddha's words. It's saying these associations with this group or that group is stupid, foolish, they're bad people, or anything like that. It's simply to recognize it's not skillful within the framework of the Dhamma. So when I stopped being a jock so I could be a collegiate, it wasn't that I didn't like the jocks anymore. It's just that I preferred being a collegiate. When I stopped creating an identity that was clinging to what was occurring in the world and the identities that I had made, it wasn't that I was saying to myself that, those associations are bad, or those people are bad, or those people are stupid. It was to preserve my own peaceful mind, or at that point, to develop it. And that's what we should all be striving for. And the more we do it, look at the if you look at all the strife in the world, and there's a lot of it going on, it all has to do with preserving associations on some level, doesn't it? I'm right and those other people are wrong. And sometimes that's just a squabble between two people. Sometimes it's a major war between two or three or ten different nations, isn't it? And it all has to do with what we've associated with. If we stop clinging to these identities we've created and stop going with the flow, even though that flow oftentimes looks like it's creating a lot of difficulties in our lives or in the world, if we weren't attached to it and weren't rooted in ignorance, we would simply recognize it and abandon it. Most people can't do that. And one of the reasons why we misunderstand even the idea of intolerance is because that allows us to continue to ignore ignorance. Some of the greatest voices against intolerance are very intolerant of the people that they're talking about, aren't they? You know, it's just an ironic but an important understanding to look at. You know? So, thank you for bringing that up. Good to see you, Mike. Isabel, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. You started a trend now. Other people are starting to ask.
I'm very grateful for this teaching tonight because it's something that I was questioning, like in the start of my week at work. Nash and I were talking about this idea. This exactly, like what this teaching, the idea of, and it's interesting that people brought it up on Tuesday class because I wasn't there for that. The idea of, is this clinging? Is this idea? And you said something that kind of just clicked in my head, is that it's like the word developing versus the word clinging. And that just brought some kind of peace to me because I was questioning and like confused and. It was stressing me out.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot, and it's... I'm getting emotional.
No, I think...
Because... we all are living this life... many of us are living this life of suffering, so to see something that can bring peace and... the beauty of it is, and then me questioning it was like stressing me out because it's like, why would I want to bring like suffering to myself within this like Eightfold Path, within these like because of these truths? And I don't know, it was just really, I'm very grateful for this teaching today because it kind of eased a lot of things inside.
That's why the Buddha taught it.
Yeah.
And obviously this was a question that was prevalent during the Buddha's time, and it was important enough for him to teach, you know, a gathering of 500 or 600 people. So they were all part of that. The that doubt that you have is very common too. In fact, the Buddha spoke to that as one of the five hindrances. And even in one of the greatest suttas of all time, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he references that in relation to being mindful. Simply to be mindful of doubt arising, but don't let it get to the point where it's overtaken you. Simply recognize that doubt is present, and just as best you can, come back to the Dhamma practice. And eventually all that doubt will fall aside. But it's there, and it can be very stressful. You know? I think we've talked about this the last couple of weeks, but also I talk about it a lot here. When people first start getting an inclination of what this, or an implication of what this means, it feels like annihilation. It feels like I'm going to have to let go of everything. What's going to happen to me? But the most important thing is to remember that there's no time frame on this, to be very gentle with yourself. And as long as you continue, the end is certain. You'll awaken. You'll gain full human maturity. And there's nothing magical, mystical, or esoteric about that. It's just practical. It's what the Buddha taught. But those feelings of doubt and anxiety are common even within this practice. I used to say this often. Maybe I'll start saying it again more often. This is a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. Because you'll come up against everything that you hold dear to establish yourself. And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to give the implication, and I'm just talking in a general sense, that if we've identified ourselves as a certain group, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not immoral or unethical. It's just unskillful as far as developing the Dhamma. Thank you for bringing it up. I'm so glad you're here tonight. Nash, good to see you tonight. How are you? I'm good, thank you.
So I had questions I wanted to ask, but I naturally have forgotten them. So I'm just going to have to remember to email you.
Please.
Questions. But I had a very auspicious morning about a week ago. I was painting a wall for my grandpa, and I was thinking about things that first, maybe it's because deep down I didn't want to be painting. I was thinking about things that upset me, and I thought to myself, I don't want to be upset about this right now. And I don't, just the idea of not wanting to add to my own suffering. So I stopped thinking about those things. And maybe it was because I had like a task to do that I was able to do that. But I just kind of like brought myself to my breathing, and like it made me kind of think of like just drawing parallels between meditation and like living, where like my distracting thoughts in life or in meditation are like my negative feelings and emotions in life. And I think I said that right. And I'm able to, like, bring myself away from them and bring myself to, like, a center and a peace for a time at least right now. Yeah. And so that was very auspicious and very gratifying. And I'm kind of trying to bring it to, like, bigger things, like, more, like, deeply rooted, like, negativity. And it seems to be doing well. Not strange. I guess I'm saying strangely because it's hard to believe. It's just this, for me, as simple as thinking, I don't know. I don't need to be upset about this. It's not even that I don't need to. I don't want to be.
Yeah.
And I am like being given or learning the tools to do that within a framework.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And even though it's ordinary, it's incredible too, isn't it? And also how quickly you can apply it and have the practical benefits of it. That the sutta, the Bhadrakarata Sutta, the sutta on an auspicious day, that's just what it talks about. And it's so important that you recognize it. And you're gaining another sutta, Vitakka Santana Sutta, the Buddha finishes that sutta by saying you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. And that's just it. That's the essence of refined mindfulness rooted in deep concentration. And why wouldn't we want to be able to think what we want to think? But if we're associated with other things, if we're going with the flow, we've lost that type of control, haven't we? And then we have to think that way, whatever way that might be. So thank you so much for bringing that up and sharing it with us. Kevin, good to see you.
Just this is a great sutta. It's really interesting. And I really appreciate everybody's reflections on it. And I think about it with the Buddha, really, it's almost like he's describing himself. He's the poor people. You know, he was rooted in his princely life and sensual activities and indulging in everything. And then he wandered and was a bhikkhu, was against the flow, and then found the Dhamma, and then awakened. It's just sort of the exact cycle of his life.
Yeah.
And he's such an amazing psychologist to think, okay, this is how most minds work, or how the world seems to work too, and is able to bring that out. It's really intense.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It really is true. Going against the flow really describes the Buddha's entire life. Even when he was, I'm thinking about, there's a reference to when the Buddha was 5 years old and he was having a rather difficult day. And he just spontaneously decided to sit under a tree and focus on his breath. That was his first meditation, at least the first that he ever talked about. And he recognized that it brought him some calm and peace just to get out of the flow of his day. And he remembered that meditation session 31 years later when he finally awakened during that last 40 days of his meditation practice. So, you're right, it's such an important sutta, and we have to recognize that at times, and this even relates to what you were saying, Isabel, at times we're going to have to go against the flow of our own thinking, and it's uncomfortable at times. Mm-hmm. It was difficult for me when I put so much into developing Mahayana Buddhism in the Tibetan tradition and the Zen tradition, that there was a period of dis-ease in that period of undoing that association in those beliefs that this was useful for me. And I'm not saying it's not useful for other people, but it wasn't useful for me. That was what I was associating with made it very difficult. But when I started realizing what the Buddha taught, and I started integrating the Eightfold Path, that path itself allowed me to recognize the clinging associations my mind had made, and then I could simply let them go at that point. So, any other questions or comments? Okay, so I had an announcement, but I can't think of what it was. Oh, we're less than a couple months from our retreat. If you're going on our retreat, please sign up. I hope you are. We'll have a great time. This is our sixth or seventh. Do you remember how many? I think it's our seventh up there.
It's only the third one for me, so I think Matt's in sixth or seventh.
Yeah. We spend 4 days in this incredible place. Within the Buddhist teachings, but it's also a very flowing weekend, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of time for teachings. I teach out of the book Becoming Buddha, but there's also a lot of time to just be at peace. So my retreats aren't silent retreats. The only time we're in silence is during meals. But the environment is very similar to the very first Sangha, the Buddha Sangha, in that we stay framed in our activities and our thoughts, words, and deeds are framed by the Eightfold Path. And that experience alone is a great way to develop the Dhamma, just to have that 4 days to be within that framework and learn how to apply it, even while we're interacting with each other and the staff up there. So.
It almost comes back to this sutta. I mean, it's like, yeah. You know, you go against the flow by starting this practice. You know, like, well, what's the flow? The world is getting busier, and you're going to just sit down? Well, that's going against the flow, right? And then you start to practice the Dhamma, and then yeah, you do that for a while, and it's going to get you somewhere. But then, there, you know, Kevin might agree. There's sort of like the intimacy of that, and 3 days of just immersing yourself in the Dhamma. There's like a mini awakening that happens. You know, yeah. It's like a, you know, you experience that fourth part, a bit of it anyway, and that's what you can take into your life again. And so it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it is. Thank you for saying that. Okay, I think that was it. So we'll finish, as we always do, with the Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on Metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.